From the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, this is Democracy Now! With the convention set to begin this evening, we bring you the protests, the parties, and a preview of the week. Also, what were Bob Dole and Jack Kemp saying to black journalists this weekend?
Secretary Kemp, after two decades of cultivating an image as a semi-soul brother in the Republican Party, what credibility do you now have with African-American voters after reversing your stand on affirmative action in merely 2 days?
We'll find out what Bob Dole had to answer. And race and politics in Mayor Daley's Chicago. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in the Convention Center, actually right outside of it in the Pavilion in Chicago. I'm joined by our national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil, our co-host who actually lives here in Chicago all year round. He's senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, the Democrats are kicking off their big nominating, or some would say coronation, party today in Chicago. Although the opening session begins with some formal party business, except a big close tonight. Highlights include a primetime speech by actor Christopher Reeve, who's paralyzed and confined to a wheelchair because of an equestrian accident. Gun control advocate Sarah Brady will also address convention delegates. Her husband James was shot during the 1981 assassination attempt on his boss, former President Reagan. Other speakers will include Senator Tom Daschle, Congressmember Dick Gephardt, and Alma Brown, whose husband, Commerce Secretary Ron Brown, was killed earlier this year in a plane crash in Croatia. The Democratic Party's only living ex-president, Jimmy Carter, is missing his first national convention since leaving office in 1981. Carter announced August 9th he would not attend. He didn't disclose why, but said he'd assured President Clinton of his support. Well, although the convention is opening tonight, a lot of things have been happening over the weekend, particularly protests, yes, in Grant Park, the site of major protests in 1968, but also just all around Chicago. And among those who have been out there are Dr. Quentin Young. He's with Physicians for a National Health Plan, which is holding a 24-hour vigil outside the convention calling for universal health care.
About a half a mile away from here, starting its deliberations tomorrow, the Democratic Party. It's our concern that they have fallen back from a commitment to national health insurance, universal national health insurance. This fear is born not out of any paranoia, we got enough of that, but out of the fact that their platform, as presented, eliminates the word universal. This is an ominous development. We want to change that. We all know, everybody in this audience knows, that the American people want that kind of reform. Every time they're polled, they say yes. Meanwhile, the politicians have denied them that. We cannot let that happen. Not only because it's not the right thing to do, bought away, that's worth an applause, but it's the only thing to do. We are on the threshold of a decline in the living, in the health standards of the American people. That's not rhetoric. There is already some ominous signs from public health data that the most vulnerable sectors are losing life expectancy and experiencing things that shouldn't happen in a country that spends $1 trillion a year on health care.
Dr. Quentin Young is a well-known activist physician here in Chicago. And by the way, Physicians for a National Health Plan will be protesting right outside the convention as opposed to the protest pen because they sued the city. And they are able to get something like 20 spots, which I think, Larry and Salim, that they will be sharing with a number of other protest groups so that at least some delegates will get to see there are protesters here at the Democratic Convention.
Right, but they won't get to see very many of them because it is limited to 20. 20 people can handle. Hand out leaflets, wave at the delegates, hold up pictures of bloody fetuses and all the other things we've come to expect outside of conventions. However, the protest pen here, Amy, is downtown in Grant Park, which is about 3 miles away. So very few delegates who don't actually seek it out will see it.
And Dr. Young was very responsible for allowing the protest to be in closer proximity. It was him. And he was very prominent, incidentally, in the 68th convention. He was administering to the wounded who were attacked by the Chicago police force. So he's been in the struggle for a while, well, very consistent.
I agree with him. Freedom of speech is healthy.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, this weekend there have been a number of protests, and there are themes to the protests in Grant Park every day. But this weekend, among the protests were marches that came together, different groups of people coming together, activists from Madison, Wisconsin, a number of Chicago activists here, people who have come from around the country. And on Saturday, there was a group of 22 protesters who were arrested in a scuffle with police during a demonstration against President Clinton's welfare reform bill, the one that he signed, and also just in general against racism.
Yeah, my name is Bonnie Bluestein. I'm with Progressive Labor Party. Yesterday afternoon, we held a march starting at Madison and Pulaski, a march to protest the fascist policies of welfare cutbacks and attacks on immigrants and all the other crap that Clinton has helped the Republicans get away with. We had a permit for this march. However, the police, in connection with the Lyndon LaRouche people, did their best to disrupt it. The LaRouche people pointed out who they wanted arrested, and the Chicago cops followed their orders and pulled those people out of the line of a legal march. When that did not succeed in disrupting the march, the police went wild. They arrested 22 people, 16 on misdemeanors, 6 are being held on felony charges.
That has the virtue of bringing us up to date on a struggle which I'm sure everyone except possibly the FBI has completely forgotten about, and that is the battle on the far fringes of the far left between progressive labor and the forces of Lyndon LaRouche. I had no idea the Progressive Labor Party even still existed. Is that a major factor here in Chicago, Sonny?
Well, I think the Clinton administration probably recruited them to demonstrate his centrist sensibilities. So if someone's on the left calling him a fascist, then he can't be all bad.
What does that mean about Wednesday, though? There will be significantly more people than were on this march this weekend, marching on the convention center led by the Reverend Al Sharpton and other people. Are those also people, you think, from Clinton Central Casting, so
no.
He can point out and say, ha-ha,
well,
those are those welfare people?
I think that will be their tactic, of course, but... No, I think, you know, Clinton is going to acknowledge their dissent. You know, he's going to acknowledge their discomfort with his stance on welfare. So I don't think they're going to be that embarrassing, but there are going to be a lot of people who will be demonstrating, and you know, out of their righteous indignation about what's happening and the fact that we are still, African-Americans especially, are still being taken for granted by the Democrats.
And you know, while President Clinton may think that this is a good photo opportunity on the outside, just as he, as we said last week, he stood in front of a chain gang of African Americans and posed with Senator Sam Nunn when he was running for president in 1992. In fact, he is concerned about dissent on the inside. And this weekend, Donna Shalala was out, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, trying to calm discontent over President Clinton's signing of the law that ends 60 years of guaranteed federal cash aid to the poor. And she was out there, for example, with the New York delegation. In particular, they are concerned about the New York delegation. A lot of the activists in that delegation are very upset over the issue of welfare. And I was looking at an AP piece, Associated Press piece, that says more than a quarter of nearly 200 delegates interviewed since Clinton signed the welfare measure last week say he was wrong, but only a few of those interviewed by the Associated Press said they would not work for Clinton's reelection.
Yeah, but look who the delegates are. It's really important. The class base of who the delegates are at this Democratic Party, only 8% of the delegates make less than $30,000 a year. Only 2% of the delegates make less than $20,000 a year. So although they've come a long way...
Say that again, Larry.
Only 8% of the delegates make less than $30,000 a year, and only 2% of the delegates make less than $20,000 a year. Now, they've done much better over the years in getting more racial balance as far as the delegates go to represent who's in the party, but they do terribly on class basis and they do terribly on age basis as well. Whereas, for example, 18% of the voters in the country who vote Democratic are 29, only 6% of the delegates are under 29. So you have something here that's skewed towards the voting class, the older, wealthier, whiter people. And I don't think those are the type of people who are going to be marching up and down in the convention aisles protesting anything.
Right. I agree with that.
You know, there is going to also be a youth convention this week, and we'll be covering that later in the week. In addition to the delegates that are inside, are going to be in the convention center, the United Convention Center here where the Chicago Bulls play and which is opening tonight. The delegates this weekend have been feted by the corporations. And yesterday I had a chance to go over to, I think you call it Scoozies. Is that right, Celine?
That's what it's called.
I don't know. At the end I was talking about it as Scuzzies because there we were, the journalists outside this fancy Italian restaurant. front. It was Philip Morris, once again, which brought us much of the Republican convention, there feting the Kentucky and Virginia delegations. And we're going to bring more to our listeners on that issue, the issue of tobacco here and overall big money at the Democratic as well as Republican conventions. But I had a chance to talk to the Kentucky Governor Paul Patton. He has just been asked to speak. I think he's going to be speaking on Thursday night. Now, why is that? He is a tobacco governor. And since President Clinton has talked about regulating tobacco now as a drug and putting limitations on advertisements to youth around tobacco, he is now trying to counter that, ameliorate some of the problems that are going to be caused, especially in the tobacco states, by bringing Paul Patton in. And I asked him if he thought nicotine was addictive. He said yes. I asked him if he thought tobacco causes cancer. And he said yes, but he doesn't think the FDA should be dealing with that. He thinks Congress should. So there are parties that are happening constantly. We'll be covering those parties as well as the protests. And yesterday, talking about parties, there was one that dealt with today, which is August 26, 1996. Today is the 76th anniversary of women getting the right to vote. I don't know if you knew this was such a significant date, guys, but it is. And there was a party called From Suffragists to Senators, Women Celebrating the Power of the Vote. The keynote speaker was Illinois Senator Carol Moseley Braun.
Dr. Martin Luther King one time referred to the Declaration of Independence as a declaration of intent. Because, as the history tells us, when it was written, African Americans were disenfranchised and counted as three-fifths of a person for purposes of the census, and women were not counted at all. The struggle for suffrage was as heroic a struggle as the struggle for emancipation and civil rights. Women challenged the existing order and won, and in so doing, helped to reach the ideals that had been so nobly set out in that Declaration of Independence and in our Constitution. And yet, in spite of that struggle, in spite of the jailings and the force feedings of the time, in spite of the presidential disdain and the popular ridicule that many of the suffragists suffered, many women, all too many women, forget and have forgotten, or worse yet, don't know the power and the responsibility that participating in this democracy entails.
And that was Senator from Illinois, Carol Moseley Braun, who's going to be a major figure this week in the convention, talking about women's right to vote 76 years ago. It was gotten today. But Moseley Braun has been involved with quite a controversy over the last few weeks, and that has been a trip that she took to Nigeria. She called it a private trip. She had hoped to keep it secret. And it was her visit with the military dictator's family there, Sonny Abacha. And after she honored women and talked about how we have to celebrate women getting the right to vote, I had a chance to ask her a question about that trip. Senator Moseley Braun, you're here celebrating the broadening of democracy in this country, giving the women the right to vote 76 years ago. But what about your trip to Nigeria, where you visited the family of the military dictator who has 7,000 political opponents in jail, oversaw the killing of Ken Saro-Wiwa? Why did you visit his family?
I've already said all that I'm going to say about that issue.
Well, since we didn't get it, why did you visit?
Well, then there's a tape of it that I can make available.
Why did you? I mean, today this is certainly a significant issue on the issue.
I can, again, we can make the tape available to you. I've said all I'm going to say on that.
These people here are among your strong supporters, obviously.
Well, I'm glad.
Okay. Are they asking you about the Nigerian trip?
I've said all that I'm going to say about this issue. I mean, I really have.
And that is Illinois Senator Carol Moseley Braun. In addition to Larry Venske and Salim Wakil, we're joined by Derek Jackson, and he's a columnist with the Boston Globe and has been writing a few columns on the issue of Nigeria. It's an issue that has gotten some attention outside of Chicago, Carol Moseley Braun's trip, but the Chicago Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune have certainly been playing it up. Derek, what was your reaction when you heard about Carol Moseley Braun's trip to Nigeria to support the military dictatorship there?
No, it was very disappointing. It was stupid, to be blunt. I mean, the evidence of the abuses of the Nigerian government are so well documented and irrefutable that for African Americans or anybody to go there, you can criticize, in fact, the Clinton administration for not taking sanctions seriously. What's interesting about that issue is that Nigeria is on a massive campaign, publicity campaign, particularly interesting among African Americans. They sponsored a Black magazine and newspaper publishers to go on a trip there back in the winter, and they came back with these glowing reviews of the government, and of course Farrakhan went as well, and so it's a situation which is very sad to see so many intelligent people not take this seriously.
Salim, she gets a very bad press here in Chicago, not only for this, but for a lot of other things. She's had four chiefs of staff in her office in mm-hmm. 4 years. She has a huge campaign finance scandal bubbling and brewing with 9,600 pages of supplementary documents that have had to be filed. Are we seeing a one-term senator?
It looks that way, you know, and one of the, you know, the more, the tragic aspect of the what makes this trip to Nigeria even more tragic is that it appears that it was done at the behest of her former fiancé, a guy named Cozy Matthews, who has a contract with the Nigerian government.
He's a
paid lobbyist, indeed. And she claimed to have severed all ties with this guy, but it appears that this was a date in Africa. I mean, a very expensive date. It cost her $6,000 or something to go, and it is enormously disappointing.
Now we're going to have to see what happens here at this convention. This was going to be kind of a coronation. Bill Clinton was very anxious to get close to her back in 1992. Here she is on her home turf in Illinois. She was going to play a leading role in front of the podium. Do you think they're still going to let her stand up there in prime time?
I think they have no choice, but there's going to be a lot of whispers. And it's really, you know, to have her do this is the ultimate of stupidity on her part. But also, some of the reaction is a bit hypocritical. A lot of these people could care less about Nigeria, and now they're so excised about Carol Moseley Braun giving comfort to these dictators.
You know, I think that's interesting, Salim, because they sent Bill Richardson, the Democrat from New Mexico, to Nigeria right after her, and the State Department chided her and said she should have been briefed before and this is not our policy. Yet, I mean, the Democrats are very good at dancing with dictators. You have President Clinton's close embrace of Suharto, one of the worst dictators
Absolutely.
In the world of Indonesia, and this is you know, pretty much business as usual. So I think that hypocrisy is very important to point out. Carol Moseley Braun has a very busy schedule this week, and she is being very closely monitored with handlers and everything. Yesterday, when I got a chance to talk to her, I was lucky I got that chance because they were saying she won't be talking to reporters. She'll be having all sorts of parties brought to us by all sorts of corporations. Tonight, she'll be hosting a party for retiring Illinois Senator Paul Simon. And these parties are brought to you by Bank America. She does serve on the Banking Committee, brought to you by Arthur Anderson and a number of others. But she doesn't want to be exposed to the press, though she wants a lot of press. There's no question about that this week, and she has been asked to speak, although the Democrats are a little queasy about what's going on right now with her and her relationship with Nigeria. I should add that while the Congressional Black Caucus has been pushing the Nigeria Democracy Act, Senator Carol Moseley Braun has been opposing it, one of the few within the Congressional Black Caucus. So,
but in fairness to Senator Moseley Braun, she is hardly the only person throwing parties here. Sponsored by multinational corporations that are bringing in hundreds of thousands of dollars. Everybody is doing it. And just like in San Diego, Amy, what are the delegates doing all day? Well, basically, some of them are playing golf, which they pay to do, and that goes into a party fund sponsored by corporations. And others are off at fundraisers, morning, noon, and night, starting at early morning at breakfast. Millions and millions of dollars will be fundraised here in Chicago. We'll talk about that during the week.
You know, it's interesting. I was asking a Virginia delegate why she thinks the corporations bring you these parties. She said, "You think we're that stupid that they could buy our vote with some spaghetti?" This was at Scoozie's last night. I said, "Well, why do you think they're doing it?" And, Governor Paul Patton of Kentucky said, because they're good corporate citizens.
Derek, what about the Massachusetts delegation? Where are they getting their money from this time?
Oh, the same place everybody else is.
What are the big Massachusetts players in funding of campaigns for John Kerry, for example?
I'm not really all that sure of all that the details of that.
But that is one of his roles here, is to raise money for his campaign against William Weld.
They're no different. But the interesting thing about Weld and Kerry is that they agreed to the $6.9 million spending cap on their own campaigns, which has been praised by the New York Times as something to take note of. But $6.9 million spending cap is not exactly cornflakes.
And one of the ironies in Chicago is that Republican officials, well-ensconced Republican corporate officials, are the ones who are coughing up the dough for the Chicago extravaganza.
You know, we're going to continue this discussion, and we're going to ask Derek Jackson what he had to say to Bob Dole and Jack Kemp, who, unlike President Clinton during the Republican convention, are not on vacation. They are actively campaigning around the country. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, Salim Wakil, and Derek Jackson. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. We're broadcasting live out of the, well, right next door to the United Convention Center, where the Democratic National Convention begins tonight. We're in one of the press pavilions, which cost millions of dollars to construct in the last few weeks. I'm here with Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times, and we're with Derek Jackson, who is with the Boston Globe and actually just came in because he was in Nashville this weekend covering the, well, part of the National Association of Black Journalists. And lo and behold, who showed up but Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. Bob Dole actually apologized, didn't he, Derek, for not going to the NAACP and addressing them?
Yes, although he did say, "I apologize for not knowing," which is a ludicrous kind of statement as well.
Especially since at the time he said that he thought Kwesi Mfume, head of the NAACP, was a liberal Democrat and that he wasn't going to get a that he felt he would get a hostile reception there. So
right. I think the interesting thing about Dole's appearance is that he did make, I think, in his own way, a sincere attempt to say that he could relate, at least in terms of having fought in World War II. Saying that talking about blood transfusions and all that didn't matter where it came from. However, it's pretty fascinating to watch the Republicans come in and try to put a gentler, kinder face on their handling with black voters, and the Clinton administration here having done a successful job of keeping things at arm's length.
Well, let's take a listen to some of the questions that some reporters got to ask of Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. The first was asked by Jane Tillman Irving, who is a New York-based reporter, and she's with WLIB, a black radio station in New York City.
The Republican platform, your party's manifesto, calls for the denial of citizenship of children, two children born in the United States if their parents are here illegally. For generations, white children of white immigrants, regardless of their status, enjoyed citizenship. Now that the new immigrants are black and brown, would you support a constitutional amendment to deny them citizenship?
No.
All right. Yes. No. So you would, your platform does call for that. But you would not support it.
Well, I pay due respect to the platform. I read a lot of the parts that I thought were essential. I approved a lot of parts that I thought were essential, and that was not one of them. I would not support that part of the platform.
You know, it's really interesting to me that the platform, which the Republicans struggled over in public, and I was there for a week, and all these controversial measures in it, not only about abortion and immigration, but many other things as well. We owe a debt to the National Association of Black Journalists. They're the first people who've jammed Bob Dole on whether or not he even read the damn thing. And now he's saying he read just parts of it. It's really extraordinary to me the way the Washington Press Corps and the campaign press corps lets Dole, and for that matter, Clinton, get away with things constantly. Did you know beforehand, the four questions, that did you sort of conspire beforehand about who was going to ask what?
We did conspire beforehand.
You have to.
And the thing was is that race had to be part of every question, because it's fundamental to the politics in this country, and certainly fundamental to this appearance before African-American journalists.
You know, it was the first time that Bob Dole said he didn't agree with a plank in the Republican platform. He said a lot that he didn't read it, and that's the way him and Kemp get away with the Republican platform that they are supposed to be championing.
It's not that hard to read. It's only about 70, 80 pages long, big type. I've read it three or four times.
You have that over him, Bob Dole.
Derek, how did they seem? Were they comfortable in your presence, or were they obviously ill at ease?
I think they were... somewhere in the middle, actually, Salim. They came in, you know, Kemp, of course, is comfortable, has all along been comfortable. And Dole had, for his purposes, a decently prepared speech.
Salim, let me ask you something. They're saying now we're going to contest every vote. There's no community we're not going to go into. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen in Chicago if, let's say, Kemp and Dole come to this neighborhood that we're in right now, for example, in just west of downtown, the Henry Horner Houses housing project right here? What kind of reception do you think that Bob Dole's message would get, or Jack Kemp, if they tried a campaign rally around here?
I think Kemp would be received with a lot more of a welcome than Dole. He has kind of cultivated the public housing constituency, although it's been mostly symbolic, of course, that nothing actually has happened, but he has spoken well and not demonized them. And so I think they will be favorably receptive to someone like Kemp.
In fact, unlike President Clinton, Jack Kemp did go to the Henry Horner Houses, and people remember that trip. You know, he is a big proponent of privatization of public housing. In a sense, Henry Horner is about that next door, because they have now a private management team. But he didn't do a lot to back up his ideas.
Exactly.
Now, we just heard Jane Tillman Irving, who's the radio reporter who got to ask a question. Then you had the print reporter, you had the TV reporter. You were representing print.
Yes.
Let's hear what you had to say, Derek Jackson, when it came to asking Bob Dole and Jack Kemp a question at the NABJ conference this weekend in Nashville.
This follows actually for Secretary Kemp.
I thought you weren't going to ask.
Secretary, similar to what I asked Senator Dole, after two decades of cultivating an image as a semi-soul brother in the Republican Party.
What do you mean semi? Hey, John Mackey, am I semi? Yes, sir.
What credibility do you now have with African-American voters after turning your back on affirmative action in this mere space of 2 days? And does your quick reversal to accept the vice presidential nomination signal that whenever African-American interests conflict with the prevailing white opinion on issues, that African-American interests will just as quickly be thrown overboard?
Well, friends...
Derek Jackson asking Jack Kemp a question at the National Association of Black Journalists Conference this weekend in Nashville about the flip-flop Jack Kemp has done in the last few days as he has become the vice presidential running mate of Bob Dole.
Yeah, I wrote a column actually before the convention, and I think it's a very dangerous sign of that race will be a wedge issue or could be a critical wedge issue, particularly if the race gets close.
When has it not been?
Well, you're right about that. It's always been an issue, but right now you have the situation where the Republicans are, for the moment, putting this sort of kinder, gentler face on their race relations. But clearly with crime, welfare, immigration, all issues involving people of color, you don't have to say people's race anymore. Right. You just do the issue. And you create a huge divide on that along those lines.
One of the things we're going to have to watch for here, you know, in San Diego, they had this whole flap about the media showing too many African-American delegates proportional to who are there. This time it's going to be interesting if it said, well, you're showing too many because there are too many. You should be showing, you know, the more white delegates in the audience. And I think that there's going to be a lot of pressure from the stages of the Democratic Convention on that level, Salim.
I think you're absolutely right. Derek, what did Kemp say?
Yeah, he said, I'm for affirmative action with a small A, and which is just saying that let's have education, let's have all these ancillary type things, none of which, of course, addresses the fact that many studies and show that African Americans with the same resume are rejected, you know, exponentially more than white job applicants. None of this spoke to job opportunity.
Well, Derek Jackson, we look forward to reading your columns this week in the Boston Globe. Fortunately, we'll get a chance to see the Boston Globe because all the newspapers are available, at least to the journalists around here.
That's the best part of the convention.
Thank you.
Derek Jackson, thanks for joining us. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with Andrew Hoffman, yes, the son of Abby. Coming up in our next hour, anti-war activists reflecting on Chicago 1968 and their children. We'll hear from attorney Len Wineglass, Paul Krasner, musician Keb Moe, Studs Terkel, Tom Hayden, and Jesse Jackson. They were all at a Nation event yesterday going back to 1968. We'll go back with them. And we're back here on Democracy Now!, broadcasting from right next to the United Convention Center, where the Democratic Convention will open tonight. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, Salim Wakil, and we've now been joined by Andrew Hoffman. You know, yesterday we went over to a Nation event that was held. The Nation magazine held a large event, 1968 to 1996, where a lot of the children and grandchildren of the activists of 1968 gathered to remember and to really celebrate the 1960s. Actually, we didn't see you up on the stage, Andrew.
No, I decided not to go up on the stage. I have been doing political actions here in Chicago for 4 years or so, and I just didn't feel like it was proper to just parade me in front of everybody with the rest of the progeny. I know that a lot of the other children of have been doing good work out there, but I had a lot of stories to tell from here in Chicago, and I didn't think that it was the right venue to tell those stories.
So. Whose shirt is that you have on, Andrew? And would you describe it to our radio audience?
This shirt actually is a shirt that I made yesterday morning. It's
looks a lot like shirts I've seen in the past.
Spray painted American flag on a white shirt. Underneath it, I'm wearing a shirt which originally was produced by the Chicago Police Department, which says on the back of it, "We kicked your father's ass in 1968. Wait till you see what we're going to do to you." Little piece of fascist humor, and I took it as so. So I printed more copies because people wanted to buy them from me. And I put on the back of mine, "Compassionate American Peace Officers for a Nonviolent Environment," which is Capone. And I'm asking all police officers in the area to get down with Capone, which is confusing to them to begin with, and then to go on to say "Compassionate American Peace Officers," then they're really confused.
At what age, first of all, your father, of course, got arrested, and they tried to throw him in jail for wearing exactly the same type of shirt that you have on right now. But times have changed, and you see it become a fashion statement now.
Yeah.
Republican as well as Democratic delegates wear garments made out of the flag,
right.
Ironically enough. But what did your father tell you? When did you learn about the 68th Democratic Convention? What did he tell you about it happened here?
It's been a part of my life. I was at the Chicago 7 trial twice.
How old were you?
I was 8 years old while the trial was going on. I absorbed it as few people who were in the courtroom did because of my age. I knew even then that it was a very important and significant event that was happening and that we were showing what the government is willing to do to crush people who are willing to stand up for their beliefs and for the little guy out there, for the soldiers and the Vietnamese people who were being brutalized by a war that didn't make sense.
Well, let's hear what your father had to say, Abby had to say in 1968.
We're 10 miles away, convention hall. You came here to disrupt the convention. They had 10 miles of barbed wire fence. They had 25,000 troops, counting the cops and National Guard. You know, they had tanks, armored tanks in the streets of Chicago. You know, National Guard with bayonets. They had helicopters with machine guns. You know, we came to disrupt the convention. Out of sight. We couldn't find a way out of the park.
You know, I was at the conspiracy trial as well, Andrew, and I remember actually seeing you there and your mother there. And what one of the things I remember about it is that of all the eight defendants, your father was the one who really got Judge Hoffman upset the most. He couldn't take it when he said his famous phrase to Judge Hoffman, Judge Hoffman, why are you being a shanda for the goyim, which means why are you being like a front man for the enemy? And Hoffman just turned bright red. Yeah. I think the Abbey really got under Judge Hoffman's skin in such a way it really drove the judge nuts.
Well, it was a funny coincidence that he happened to have the same last name, and my father never was one to shy away from a good joke, and I've got all the old buttons, screw Magoo, you've seen one judge, you've seen them all.
In fact, didn't your father refuse to be called Abby Hoffman at the trial? He just wanted to be called Abby because he didn't want to share that same
name,
last name.
Right. And then on the other hand, he declared to the press that he had looked through family records and found out that Hoffman was actually a long-lost relative of
That's
his.
Right. That's right. Julie, he said. I remember standing up saying, Julie, your brother, Paisan.
Well, yeah. Andrew, what's your assessment of the goings-on in Chicago this week?
This week? Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to get to that. I mean, contrast is beautiful art here. It's like the police now, they seem like they're all on Thorazine or something. They've got this sort of demoralized little smile, and they just don't know what to do with themselves. They're riding around in circles around Grant Park on four-wheel vehicles. They don't even have Harleys anymore. The poor guys, I feel sorry for them. I think we should do a reenactment and get 5,000 cops and 5,000 hippies together and have it out in Grant Park, only this time we'll use plastic bats and baseballs. And
well, do you think in some ways the demonstrators won the battle?
I think that the demonstrators, or as I like to refer to the movement as the youth of the world now, not just America, have won the war. We still have a lot of battles to win. We have to fix the environment. We have to take care of the social ills that are plaguing our society now. But I think that because of the communication revolution that's happening, because of the education that is becoming more widespread, that young people are going to take control of their society, their environment, and that the establishment is going to be pushed out, and that we're going to be done with the corporate greed that's going on.
What do you make of the fact that only 4% of the delegates to the Democratic Convention are under 30?
Well, it was Abby who coined the phrase, don't trust anybody over 30. And then he said, don't trust anybody under 30. I just don't trust anybody. And
Andrew,
I'm from Boston. I guess that's the way we are.
In a few minutes, you're going to go give a speech. There's a theme to every day of the protests in Grant Park. Today, it's what? Communities and jobs. What are you going to be talking
homelessness,
about?
Homelessness. I'm going to be talking about my new organization, which is dedicated to the memory of my father, which is called America's Soup Kitchen on Wheels, which is as much about bridging gaps in communities and building a movement from the street the way my father taught me and so many others here in America, that's the only way to start a solid movement is from the streets. And we'll be out there with food and just talking with the people and doing street theater and comic relief on the street.
Does your group have a phone number?
Yeah, I was just going to
yes.
ask that.
We have a number in Boston, which is 617-666-3646. Or you can get in touch with us at P.O. Box 390074, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 021-3239.
Well, let's stay with the phone number, 617. It's a lot easier for radio listeners.
Right.
617-666-3646 for the organization called?
America's Soup Kitchen on Wheels.
And it's going to need it.
Tax-deductible, nonprofit organization, so we would appreciate any donations.
Help. Any help, we say.
Yeah, and we really want to urge people also to get involved with doing the Soup Kitchen in other communities. I've been doing it in Boston for a while. I'm trying to break into the Chicago scene with a van here. And I'd like to have a van in any community. So if you're interested in volunteering, call us up.
Andrew, we have to wrap up, but I do have to say that your outfit is quite funny here within the Democratic Convention because you're wearing an American flag shirt. You've got it over a T-shirt that says, "We kicked your daddy's ass and we're going to kick yours now." But you had to wear the credential to get in here. And so on top of all this, you're wearing your 1996 Democratic National Convention credential, which hangs on a United Airlines shoestring.
Appropriate for the United Center.
Quite a composite. Well, thank you very much.
The Hoffmans and Daleys are doing it all over again here in Chicago. Deja vu.
Andrew Hoffman. Thanks for being with us.
We could skip the trial this time. Thank you.
Peace.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to talk about race and politics in Daily Chicago. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. We're broadcasting live from right next to the United Convention Center in the Press Pavilion. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil, senior editor in These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. And Salim, you wrote a very interesting piece last weekend in the Washington Post on Chicago politics.
The piece essentially said that the younger Mayor Daley, or as we affectionately call him, R2-D2, has managed to have the same effect as his father did with his rude machine and squashing all opposition, especially black opposition. I go into a few of the reasons and some of the history of the city and why that has happened. But since Daley's election in 89, 2 years after the late sainted Harold Washington, who was the first Chicago black mayor, died, there have been six challenges to his position, and they've all failed. None of the black challengers have seemed to be able to mobilize the vote in any kind of serious way. And we have with us Bob Starks, who's the professor of a professor of political science at Northeastern Illinois University and chair of the Task Force for Black Political Empowerment. And we also have on the phone with us Don Rose, who is a longtime observer of local politics. He was a strategist, a political consultant to both the late Mayor Harold Washington and former Mayor Jane Byrne. And he's also doing some some stuff with Governor Jim Edgar, so he's bipartisan, I guess you could say. And I'd like to ask you, Bob, why has the black community been able to mount what has been a successful challenge to Mayor Daley?
Why hasn't it not been able to?
Why has it not?
Simply because Daley is a rather keen observer of what I call the individualism, the sort of snide selfishness of the black political elite in this city. And he has very wisely bought off that elite. And
by elite, who do you mean?
Black elected officials, some black activists, former activists who are now on the inside. So he has developed a rather, successful strategy of buying off the counter elites, if you will.
How does he buy them off?
By giving them contracts for city, the city's in a process of privatizing numbers of services. So he's given them contracts for that. He's given them somewhat limited access to his office. He's bought them in as sort of pseudo advisors, that kind of stuff. And to many people, unfortunately, that is enough to buy their silence and enter inaction.
Don Rose, do you agree with that assessment?
I agree with that very largely. Of course, his father was an expert at buying off
absolutely
the levels of black leadership as well. But Daley has done, the younger Daley, some call him R2-D2, some call him son of boss or SOB.
Well, I call him Little Richard.
he's done this. I think
I'm sure the real Little Richard would be insulted.
There's one key aspect, and that is immediately following the death of Harold Washington, there was a split in the black community. And to some extent also the white progressive community that supported the Washington movement. And that split, I think, helped depress the initial surge of movement.
Absolutely.
When Daley first ran. Mm-hmm. And he got into office, I think, largely because of the split. And after that was able to buy off an awful lot of his opposition. He bought off the white progressive opposition in many ways just as perhaps even more easily than he did some of the black opposition.
Absolutely.
You mean by offering offering them jobs within his administration and that kind of thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that is absolutely true.
Without going into names and personalities, just there was a woman who was once Harold Washington's campaign press secretary who now gets $1.5 million contracts from the mayor for promoting various of his civic enterprises.
What about Richard Daley's brother, Bill Daley, who is also a powerhouse here in Chicago? He's been widely credited with pushing NAFTA through Congress as Bill Clinton's advisor in 92 Illinois chair of his campaign. He's what, right now he's the co-chair of the host committee here,
yeah, right,
and is a corporate lawyer.
Some people think that, and I think I would largely agree, and probably Don would too, that Bill Daley is the smarter of all the Daley children. He's sort of the godfather, if you will. It's interesting, however, and we should speculate about this, why he was never given a cabinet post in the Clinton administration.
Right, he was being considered for Secretary of Transportation.
But and each time he was also considered for a number of other things, but each time he went up, he was bounced back, and I don't know why. But,
well, the main reason he didn't get Secretary of Transportation was that Clinton was under pressure at two levels. One, there was still some vestigial concerns about, quote, Chicago machine politicians. And number two, he was also under pressure to put another black or brown face in the machine. In the cabinet.
You said it right, in the machine.
And so he was supplanted by a minority because Clinton had made this pledge to make the cabinet more like the face of America or some such phrase.
Well, speaking of that whole racial issue, there's been some criticism of the black organizing attempt to oust Daley. There's been criticism that attempt has been too tinged with nationalism, that the black political leadership hasn't been willing to look at cross-racial or perhaps even a white candidate. I mean, there were many people who said David Orr would have been the best choice to oppose Daley.
David Orr
was a former alderman, he was mayor for a minute or two after Harold Washington died, and now he's the clerk of the county. And he's a pretty long-standing progressive who has a good reputation in various communities. Don Rose, do you think that the kind of nationalist filter prevented David Orr from being considered?
Well, I assume there are people who wanted a black mayor rather than a white supporter, and that has to be one of the reasons, probably the main reason, why David Orr, who otherwise has fine credentials.
Do you think the thrust for
reform goes in two directions? There's a thrust for political reform, be it colorblind, and there is also a thrust for a black mayor, because we had just lost a black mayor.
And Bob Starks, as the chair of the task force for black political empowerment, mm-hmm. that is in fact your position, right?
Yeah.
You want black political empowerment. Would you have ever accepted David Orr? Do you think he would have been a credible candidate?
I think David would have been a credible candidate. The question, however, is I don't know if the white community would have supported David. And that's a question that I don't think even David can answer. I think David himself would say that he would have had a hard time getting a kind of progressive main thrust boost from the white community other than his ward and maybe Hyde Park. But outside of that, he would have probably suffered the same fate as all the other black candidates that have run.
We're talking with Bob Starks, who is professor of political science at Northeastern Illinois University and chair of the Task Force for Black Political Empowerment. Also on the phone with us, Don Rose, an observer of local politics, longtime strategist and political consultant to the late Mayor Harold Washington. I wanted to ask this question, which has to do with leadership in the black community. And that is, you've got a couple leaders here, which is interesting. I mean, you've got Jesse Jackson, who comes out of Chicago in Operation Push. You've got Louis Farrakhan, whose home base of operations is right here. And yet, basically, you have a white elite power structure in Chicago. What is the role that they play? Do they have any significant power in this city?
Well, Jesse Jackson certainly has power. He has influence. However, Jesse is a national Democrat. He is probably closer to Richard Daley than most of the African-American leadership in this city. He has not done one single thing to criticize Richard Daley. He has been certainly more cooperative with this administration than one would expect. So he is an insider. He has not expressed the kind of outrage and leadership that he had prior to leaving Chicago and going to Washington. Mr. Farrakhan, on the other hand, is an outsider. He's sort of on the outside of the mainstream political stream, and therefore has little influence with the administration. However, I think those things may be changing if, in fact, he gets his voter registration program off the ground and his national convention going. He may, in fact, enter in a big way.
What about this national convention, the convention of the oppressed that
the
he says he's going to be?
The poor and the oppressed. It's set for 27th through 29th September in St. Louis. But, you know, what I wanted to ask you also, Bob Starks, is assess the Daley administration. You said that he's bought off a lot of black former opposition, but he's also been a rather unique mayor in the fact that he still supports set-asides pretty strongly. He still supports affirmative action. Do you think there are any good qualities of the mayor that can legitimately claim support?
Well, the only good thing is that his term is up in 99. in my opinion. That's the only good thing I can say about Little Richard. Little Richard is a dictator. He is a mean-spirited, hateful, selfish little dictator who has played politics rather well. And it surprises me that there isn't more outrage as a result of that, however. I can say very few good things. Maybe Don can redeem me here and find some good things about Richard, but I can't find very little.
Can you, Don?
Oh, at the risk of sounding like a daily defender.
That's why I said it, Richard.
I can certainly, you know, find some aspects. Right. I think that the important thing is that he has not, you know, if you grant some of the things Bob says, this daily has been very wise in making himself a moving target. He has not become the clear-cut oppressor that his father was. Daly has been very wise in covering actions. He has always had a black press secretary, for example. He has made some moves that should outrage the community, but he skirts around them and seems to avoid a lot of the blame. I can't say it's Teflon because he doesn't get that many darts thrown at him, or certainly very few of the darts hit him.
And the charges.
He's a skillful politician in handling the race issue.
And the charges against the charges that people make against him are seldom amplified because the media seems to be quite happy with him.
Yes, right. Well, no, I would agree, and I think Don, in all seriousness, I think Don is probably correct in the sense that he has made himself a moving target. So I really don't blame Daly. I blame the black leadership in this city.
Well, you are a pivotal part of that leadership.
Oh, I am, really?
Yes,
I've been elevated. No, seriously. I have, and I'm really appalled at the fact that the leadership has not been as verbose as it could. This leadership has been more quiescent than I.
And why?
Would
why
have
do you
expected.
Think that is?
I really don't know. I think it has a lot to do with what happened after Harold's death in 1987. That's, you know, about 10 years ago. I think it has a lot to do with the changing political circumstances, the conditions, the fact that there's a massive land grab going on in the city that's been going on for the last 10 years that has displaced thousands of people from traditional neighborhoods and change the configuration.
And the regentrification.
It really has.
The land grab has been going on for a lot more than 10 years.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You're absolutely right. This is a real estate-driven town,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that is where race really comes in to the forefront.
How about unions? It's also a union town where the average, I think, of percentage of union members in this country is 15%. In this in this city, it's 25%.
Historically, the unions have been in the pocket of
exactly.
The previous Mayor Daly, and
this
remain
one too.
In the pocket of the current Mayor Daly.
That's right.
The unions are, for the most part, not all, but for the most part, the unions are as much a part of the machine as the Wall Street financiers, the LaSalle Street financiers.
Precisely.
Well, so then, is Little Richard, as you put it, Bob, is he in there for life or what?
No, I think Little Richard really wants to become Little Richard the governor or Little Richard the senator or something. I don't think he would be satisfied to stay mayor for 25 years or 22 years as his father did. I think he really wants to move on to something else. And I think he's really searching and hoping that something will come along by 98 to push him out of that position.
He's going to have to clean up some of his malapropisms if he's going to make it. I was just going through some of his and his father's.
The way you put it.
Daly 68.
He's dumb.
1968, Mayor Daly said, "The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. Mayor Daly in the 1990s, R2-D2, as you say, said, "The more killing and homicide that you have, the more havoc it prevents." Let me say that again. The more killing and homicides you have, the more havoc it prevents. Let's hope he didn't mean that.
Well, no, he's literally true. It prevents less havoc from those who were killed. So he's absolutely correct in that.
Well, we want to thank you both for joining us. Bob Starks, a professor of political science at Northeastern Illinois University and chair of the Task Force for Black Political Empowerment, and Don Rose, an observer of local politics, strategist and political consultant to the late Mayor Harold Washington, former Mayor Jane Byrne, and current Governor Jim Edgar. Well, Democracy Now! Comes to an end on this first day of live coverage from the Democratic National Convention. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. We had help from Michael Yoshida. He is our engineer, and help from Janice K. Bryant and Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to call our comment line, 202-588-0999. That's 202-588-0999. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil. Thanks very much for joining us from Chicago for this special coverage of the Democratic National Convention.